The following is provided through the IAAIS Program Share Service.
Hello, and welcome to Pet Paws, the program dedicated to domestic animals of all varieties. I'm Wes Ortgeson for the Virginia Voice. We begin this time with the Richmond Times-Dispatch and an article dated April 6th, Saturday. Virginia equestrian judge found guilty on 5 counts of starving horses. Written by Luca Powell. Rareshride, a well-known name in Virginia's equestrian world, stood accused of animal cruelty to 13 horses that were in her care at her farm in Goochland County. She was acquitted on 8 counts. The decision came on Friday evening after Goochland Circuit Court Judge Timothy Sanner had heard from 25 witnesses involved with Rareshride's horse farm. Sanner was ultimately asked to choose between two sharply different interpretations of the facts presented at trial, most of which related to events during the winter of 2022. In the Commonwealth's interpretation, Rareshide had let 13 horses become so thin that they were near death. Goochland Commonwealth's attorney John Lumpkins Jr. put veterinarians from 4 different clinics on the stand. The veterinarians presented a united argument that the horses were malnourished. In the interpretation presented by Rareshide's defense lawyer, Craig Cooley, the horses were not malnourished, but simply thin, just days away from the renewal brought by budding spring grasses. Cooley presented Rareshide as an attuned horsewoman, a devoted caretaker in touch with nature's way of shepherding her horses through winter. She would never hurt a horse, Cooley said. After 2 hours of deliberation, Sanner emerged from his chambers to say he was more convinced by the veterinarians. This court has to place a greater weight on the testimony of experts, said Sanner, acknowledging that the pressures of economic inflation and Rareshide's own feeding philosophy influenced his decision. Rareshide was found guilty in relation to the treatment of the horses Patrick, Terra, Opal, Loki, and Ruby. All were former show horses who had been boarded at her farm, the Bird's Nest, to live out a bucolic retirement. Instead, they were starved, according to numerous witnesses and veterinarians who spoke throughout the 3-day trial. Patrick's stomach began to digest the lining of his own throat and heart. Terra's veterinarian said he was so skinny, something as simple as a cold snap would likely require him to be euthanized. Loki, whose face had begun to swell from late-stage starvation, was too frail to be loaded into a trailer. Veterinarians use a scoring metric called body condition score, a sliding scale of their well-being that ranges from 1 to 9. A horse at a 9 would be severely overweight, while a horse with a score of 1 would be severely emaciated. Most of the horses mentioned in Rareshide's trial scored between a 1 and a 3. Skeletal was how veterinarian Paul Anikas described Terra. 4 horses removed from her retirement farm were ultimately euthanized, although it's not clear if their euthanasia was attributed to their treatment at the farm. Rareshide declined to comment on Sanner's verdict after the trial. The decision came on the heels of a morning of testimony by Rareshide, alongside friends and business associates who sang her praises. The former horse show judge said each horse was getting a bale of high-quality alfalfa every day. Rareshide described sparing no expense on specialized feeds. Some days the horses were fed up to 4 times, she told Sanner. The winter had also been particularly harsh, she said. She always took care of them top-notch, said her farm assistant Elizabeth Fitzgerald. A friend, Annette Elizabeth Murphy, testified that pasture-kept horses go through a cycle where they drop weight in the winter before ballooning in the spring. Murphy said horses eating too much coming out of winter can founder. Foundering refers to a blood condition that can arise when horses eat too quickly and lose the ability to regulate insulin properly. The condition can result in severe pain in a horse's hooves and lead them to become lame. To prevent founder Murphy, Murphy said retired horses should be allowed to enter spring thin. Horses that are pasture kept should be allowed to go through the cycle, said Murphy, who also said Rareshide had the best grass. And her hay supplier, John Richard Lloyd, said Rareshide was one of his highest volume customers. Judge Sanner said he found their testimony credible, but also that most of them had not been around the farm during the events in question. His verdict, he said, was not based on body condition scores alone, but also on the overall conditions of some of the horses retrieved from her farm. Opal, for example, became so depressed from apparent starvation that she was uninterested in food and would no longer react to stimuli. Her body condition score was a 1. Opal's owner, Lori Custer, said her horse is now fat as a tick since being removed from the bird's nest. Her other horse, Cannonball, also stayed with Rareshide and was put down in the summer of 2023. Without the intervention, courage, and persistence of the local veterinary and horse community, my horse, Opal, would not have survived the winter of 2023. Custer said after hearing the verdict, I applaud the prosecution in realizing a guilty conviction for 5 of the 13 horses. My heart is forever broken for my horse, says Lori Custer. Cannonball, as well as the remaining 8 horses and countless others who suffered unnecessarily in the hands of Bird Rareshide, Custer said, and my heart felt condolences to all the other owners of the horses who did not receive justice today. Rareshide's sentencing is scheduled for May 24th. And that's the article in the Richmond Times-Dispatch for Saturday, April 6th. Virginia equestrian judge found guilty on 5 counts of starving horses, written by Luca Powell. And now we turn our attention to the cats. Cornell Cat Watch, health and wellness information from the experts at the Cornell Feline Health Center. Are lawn chemicals harmful? Sometimes, but attention to detail helps minimize risk. A pristine green lawn is lovely to look at, but difficult to maintain. Many lawn aficionados use a variety of products to combat both weeds and insects that feed on grass. These pesticides, insecticides, fertilizers, and herbicides can all potentially be toxic to your cat. How cats get exposed. It makes sense that cats who go outside are exposed to lawn care products. They explore both their own yards and other yards, and their short stature brings them into direct contact with anything on the grass. Cats also sniff as they patrol the area and may inhale products. But indoor, cats are not immune to these risks. We can track lawn chemicals into the house on our shoes and clothing, exposing our cats when they brush against us, sniff our clothes, or walk through any spills or contaminated footprints. If a cat walks through an area recently sprayed with a lawn care chemical or a puddle of spilled product, they can then ingest the product when grooming. Signs of toxicity. The exact signs that your cat has been poisoned by a lawn care product will vary depending upon the exact product she was exposed to and how much of it she ingested, inhaled, or absorbed. If you suspect that your cat is experiencing toxicity from a lawn care product or know that she has been exposed, call a pet poison hotline. Again, and that's to get the most recent information on risks, signs, and treatment. The severity of harmful effects will often vary depending on the dose to which your cat was exposed. Small exposures may have no obvious effects at first, but chronic exposure can build up over time. We know this because studies have, for example, found metabolites of glyphosate and a variety of pesticides in cat urine. And a study done in Italy found polychlorinated biphenyls and DDT in cats' fatty tissue. At this point, we do not have exact data on how much of which lawn care products can lead to toxicity for cats, or the differences in risk between acute exposure and chronic low-grade exposure. Studies in humans and dogs have suggested a connection between cancer and some lawn care products. To be safe, minimize your cat's exposure to these products as much as possible. Safe application. Many lawn care products have the potential to cause harm if used incorrectly. Many states require commercial farmers and lawn care professionals to take safety courses and pass a licensing exam to apply pesticides, herbicides, and other products. Individual homeowners usually are not required to go through the processes, even though they have access to the exact same products. One easy way to increase the safety of your lawn care is to hire a professional. Lawn care professionals are familiar with the products they are using and have all of the personal protective equipment needed to apply the chemicals safely. If you want to handle your lawn care yourself, protect yourself, your family, your pets, and wildlife by reading all product instructions and following safety guidelines. Take the time to calculate the size of your lawn accurately. Wear protective gear and take off any exposed clothing before you go back in your house. Product labels are a good place to start, but for the full story, you will need to look up each product safety data sheet, the SDS. For our indoor-outdoor cats, the most important piece of information is how long to keep your cat off the lawn after applying a product. Most products take 1 to 2 days to absorb into the ground or be washed off. Note, organic and pet-friendly products can still be harmful to your cat if eaten. These products often still have a drying time during which you will need to keep your cat off the lawn to prevent any accidental ingestion. Are lawn chemicals harmful? That's an article in the latest April edition of Cornell Cat Watch. And speaking of April, we now go to Catnip. This is the newsletter for caring cat owners from Tufts University Cummings School of Medicine. And this is the April edition. Easter comes and Easter goes, but lilies' threat to cats is forever. No part of the lily plant is safe for felines. Some nurseries advertise that pollen-free lilies are safe for cats. They're not. In fact, all parts of the lily plant are poisonous for felines. A cat can suffer fatal kidney failure just from nibbling on a lily leaf or even drinking water from a vase with cut lilies in it. It doesn't have to be the pollen that's released from little pods atop the thin filaments in the middle of the flower. The danger from eating any part of a lily is so great that if you have lilies in the house or in a garden that's accessible to your pet and notice your cat suddenly seeming seriously ill, you need to get her to the emergency room as quickly as possible. Her kidneys can very quickly stop producing urine, and if they do, she might die. With lily ingestion, there is zero time to lose. Even if your pet lives, she will most likely be in the hospital for a couple of days on an IV drip. Believe us, we know. Lilies are one of the three substances responsible for the majority of poisonings for which cats are brought to the small animal hospital at Tufts. The other two are acetaminophen, or Tylenol, the generic name for Tylenol, and topical anti-flea products meant for dogs, but mistakenly applied to cats. They contain too much of the active ingredient permethrin. To help those who have cats avoid the danger and also the heartache, International Cat Care and Australia Center for Veterinary Education at the University of Sydney have collaborated in designing a poster that can be displayed at the point of sale in supermarkets, florists, and other outlets that sell flowers. Entitled Lethal Lilies, it makes the point succinctly that cats and lilies do not go together, whether or not there is pollen. Matching the lily to the safety issue, a sidebar. Calls and peace lilies, I should say calla or calla and peace lilies, don't cause fatal kidney failure, the Food and Drug Administration points out. Feline kidney failure results from ingestion of any part of Easter lilies, that's Easter lilies, as well as tiger, Asiatic, bay, and Japanese show lilies. But the calla, C-A-L-L-A, and peace varieties can irritate your cat's mouth and esophagus, the FDA says, and lilies of the valley are toxic to the feline heart. So beware. Easter comes and goes, but lilies' threat to cats is forever. That's in the April edition of Cat Nip. Going now to the dogs and the Whole Dog Journal. We're going to look at another article written by Pat Miller, who is a behaviorist. What can a veterinary behaviorist do for you? When consulting with one, may help your dog. All experts approach problems from the perspective of their education and experience. Given a dog with problematic behavior, a trainer may recommend equipment changes, behavior modification, and management steps. A veterinarian may prescribe medications that reduce anxiety and increase social behavior. However, behavioral problems can result from neurochemical imbalances, medical conditions, past life experiences, current living conditions, and every combination of these. Veterinary behaviorists are uniquely positioned to use tools from both medicine and behavior science to most accurately diagnose and efficiently treat dogs with severely problematic behavior, such as aggression, self-mutilation, phobic or extremely fearful, and severe separation anxiety. One of the most valuable benefits of working with a veterinary behaviorist is their extensive knowledge of how psychotropic medications can further your dog's behavior modification program. By law, only veterinarians can prescribe or give you prescription medication for your dog. Some owners are resistant to using behavior medication for their dogs. Sometimes their resistance stems from working with a veterinarian who wasn't experienced enough with behavior modifying medications to tweak the dog's prescriptions for the best results. The client's dog may have been given medication that was too strong. I don't want my dog to be a zombie or too weak. It didn't do anything. This is sad because often medication can make the most impactful contribution to improving the dog's quality of life. In many cases, the right medication or medications can make a good training professional's behavior modification program much more successful and much sooner. If you are working with skilled training professionals, the addition of the right medication might make the visit with the behaviorist unnecessary. But if either your trainer nor your vet have answers to your dog's challenging behavior, or when they are failing to work together to provide an all-encompassing treatment plan for your dog, a consultation with a veterinary behaviorist is well worth the cost. What to expect from a VB consultation, veterinary behavior consultation? A particularly thorough medical and behavior history is the first prerequisite for any veterinary behaviorist consultation, with the behavior history being the longest and most detailed part of the intake form. When did the problematic behavior first start? How often does it happen? And how has it changed? The behaviorist also needs to know what interventions have been tried and how the dog responded to those treatments. The intake form will also ask the owner, what are your goals for your dog? What outcome do you hope for? If the problematic behavior is unlikely to be observed in a veterinary office setting, the owner will be asked to try to capture video of the dog while he's displaying the troubling behavior. Video can often provide the most valuable clues to the causes or significant contributors, to the dog's behavior. After reviewing all of the above, the veterinary behaviorist will then meet with the dog and owner in order to observe the dog's behavior firsthand, or at least via a video conference. At the end of the first visit, the client is usually given some management strategies that can be implemented right away, especially if the dog's behavior has the potential for endangering anyone. Afterward, the veterinary behaviorist will prepare a comprehensive treatment plan for the dog's owner, which is typically reviewed and discussed in a subsequent appointment. The plan may include a request for medical testing or further medical testing in order to diagnose or rule out medical contributors to the problematic behavior. Usually, it will also include recommendations for the owner to undertake behavior modification exercises under the guidance of a training professional working with or recommended by the veterinary behaviorist. The treatment plan may also recommend the use of supportive therapies such as supplements, nutritional therapy, and/or prescription medications when appropriate. Because there are few veterinary behaviorists, it's impossible for many dog owners to book an in-person consultation with one. That's why most of these professionals also offer phone or video consultations with their clients' veterinarians. Instead of seeing the dog and owner, they will review the veterinarian's report of the dog's issues and directly communicate with the dog's veterinarian to offer suggestions for further medical testing, medication, and behavioral interventions. Some veterinary behaviorists have a solo practice where they provide clients with support and referrals to other training or medical professionals as necessary. Others work in group practices where other staff veterinarians can provide any diagnostic testing that the veterinary behaviorist recommends, and the staff trainers will work with the client and the client's dog on behavior modification exercises. Sample case history. We asked a veterinary behaviorist to describe a typical case to illustrate how these professionals draw on their medical and behavioral expertise differently than their vet or trainer peers. Chris Paschal, owner of the Animal Behavior Clinic in Portland, Oregon, accommodated us with a description of one of his veterinarian-to-veterinarian consultations. The patient was a 3-year-old intact male Labrador who had perpetrated a number of troubling episodes of what was described as unpredictable and unprovoked aggression in his home. His humans were highly experienced dog owners who were active in dog sports and had other dogs in the home, including additional dogs who would sometimes stay with them in a casual boarding scenario. While the patient was usually a social butterfly with an affable temperament, the owners described a number of incidents where he had suddenly behaved aggressively. Fortunately, they had 3 of these incidents captured on video, thanks to their home security system. One incident where the patient became aggressive with his male owner occurred in the backyard of the home where other dogs were present. In another incident, the dog aggressed toward that man's mother when she moved the chair that was 3 or 4 feet from the dog. In the 3rd incident captured on video, the patient aggressed toward a visiting dog. Since the patient was perfectly social and appropriate in between these incidents, even in situations that were identical to the conditions in which he showed aggression, the owners brought the dog to their vet. About 6 months prior to the first aggressive incident, the dog had slipped and fallen with his front legs splayed out in an unnatural position. His owners were concerned that he might be experiencing pain that caused him to lash out at others. On physical exam, their vet did find some pain and prescribed pain medication. The dog's pain went away, but the troubling behavior did not. So, with the client's approval, the veterinarian scheduled a consultation with Dr. Paschal. It's always necessary to have someone provide a thorough physical examination, but it doesn't have to be me, Dr. Paschal explains. In this case, he discussed the results of the primary care veterinarian's physical exam, neurologic exam, and notes regarding the dog's response to pain medication. He also read the behavior history and viewed the owner's video clips. From early on, Dr. Bichelle suspected a medical cause for the aggression. What stood out to me was the inconsistent relationship between the antecedents, things that happened around the dog prior to the aggression, and the behavior, Dr. Bichelle says. Seeing the variability and expression of those aggressive behaviors and understanding that the dog has been in identical situations hundreds of times without editing any aggression, the most notable thing about the incidents were how inconsistent they were. That increased my level of suspicion that something internal, not external, was driving the incidents. The inconsistency also made me think about potential causes that have a waxing and waning, a variable expression, such as hormonal issues or endocrine-related disorders. Dr. Bichelle first suggested that the dog's vet run a comprehensive thyroid profile, a laboratory test. Dogs whose bodies produce too much or too little thyroid often experience changes in behavior and coping skills. However, the test results were normal. Next, he considered endocrine conditions that could have an intermittent influence impacting the dog's ability to respond to mild provocations and stress. He suggested testing the dog for Addison's disease, which may have appeared to the dog's primary care vet as a stretch. The dog had never had an Addisonian crisis, collapse, lethargy, dehydration. His electrolytes were normal. There were none of the hints in his blood work that would make you want to run an ACTH stim test, a test that demonstrates the capacity of the dog's adrenal glands to produce cortisol, describes Dr. Bichelle. It was the waxing and waning nature of the aberrant behavior and lack of response to the other treatments that led me in that direction. While he may have thought the test was a shot in the dark, when the results came back, the dog's primary care vet was happy to report that the picture was now clear. The dog had Addison's disease, a deficiency of the hormones that regulate electrolytes, blood pressure, hydration, metabolism, and stress responses. Addison's patients require lifelong supplementation of those hormones, but thankfully, with treatment, the dog's troubling behaviors stopped. The term behaviorist is in wide but variable use. Would it surprise you to learn that literally anyone can call himself or herself a behaviorist? The title means nothing. There are any number of dog trainers, qualified and unqualified, educated and uneducated, who call themselves behaviorists. However, here are a few that include behaviorists that actually do mean something. Veterinary behaviorist. Only licensed veterinarians who have been certified by the can use the title of veterinary behaviorist. The formal term is diplomat or diplomat. American College of Veterinary Behaviorists, DACVB. You can find veterinary behaviorists on the internet. Certified Applied Animal Behaviorist, CAAB, and Associate Certified Applied Animal Behaviorist, ACAAB. These are the scientists, educators, or other animal professionals with advanced academic backgrounds in the principles of animal behavior. Certified Dog Behavior Consultant, CDBC. Certified Animal Behavior Consultant, CABC. These certifications are bestowed by the International Association of Animal Behavior Consultants, which often offers animal credentialing examinations for several animal species and specialties. Is it just marketing? It bears repeating. Anyone can call themselves a behaviorist. The term doesn't guarantee that they are educated or experienced with complex behavior problems. When hiring a dog trainer, we recommend you choose a behavior professional who is certified by and or member of one of the organizations that they listed there, and you can find those on the internet. And that's the article from the April edition of the Whole Dog Journal, What Can a Veterinary Behaviorist Do for You? And that's all the time we have for Pet Paws this time. I hope you'll join us again next time. I'm Wes Ortgeson for the Virginia Voice.